Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
If you've been driving around the city lately, or honestly a lot of the time, you may have noticed that we have the odd pothole here and there. It's something that has been a bit of an issue for this city over the years. We've been on a few lists of worst roads here and there, and potholes have been one of those things that I think drives a lot of people crazy, including, I'm willing to bet, my two guests up next. Carolyn Ryall is the Director of Transportation, and Mark Priest is the District Superintendent of Roadway Maintenance for the City of Hamilton. Folks, thanks for doing this today.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having us.
Carol, let's go to you first on this, because this, look, I don't believe that anything I'm about to say is going to be a surprise or a shock to you. I'm sure you've heard everything from everybody, but we have potholes in this city. What do we do about that?
So thanks for the question, Scott. So, well, there's many ways we can deal with it. First, if you are a resident or you are a motorist driving on City of Hamilton roads and streets, we'd love to hear about them. You can provide that information to us through 546 City, where they are logged, reviewed, tracked, and repaired. We also have a process in place where we have our road patrollers that are out and about patrolling the road network, and they're also identifying, tracking, reviewing, and repairing as required as well.
I read today, and maybe this number, you can tell me if this is correct. Does the city actually repair 90,000 potholes a year? Is that correct?
Yeah, on average, between 70,000 to 90,000 potholes per year are addressed throughout the City of Hamilton. That is correct.
All right. One more thing with Carolyn before I move on to Mark. Why is, I mean, is that an extraordinarily high number? That seems like an awful lot.
Compared to other municipalities, I don't think it is. I think if we're looking at, you know, other benchmark municipalities similar to us, I think the 90,000 is roughly what they're dealing with as well. You know, most municipalities are dealing with obviously road condition, the freeze and thaw that we deal with here up in Ontario. So it's pretty normal annualized, I think, with how we deal with it.
Mark, Carolyn just mentioned the freeze and thaw. This is something I think people who have paid attention to this over the years have heard quite often, that the process of you get water into the crack and then the freeze comes and that expands and makes the crack go bigger and then it melts and then the road gets loose. Am I pretty close to my accurate definition of how this works?
Yeah, that's pretty accurate. We do obviously experience that here in Ontario throughout the winter season. Obviously, this winter season was a little bit more kind to us, but a typical winter season does present those challenges. Indeed, the moisture gets into the road surface, and we do our absolute best to do those repairs in a timely fashion.
You just got to the thing I was going to ask about, though. This winter, we were lucky with not terrible conditions. We didn't have a ton of these freeze and thaws, and we certainly didn't have a ton of snow. Did we dodge any bullets, or are the roads in the same shape they are now that they would have been expected to be any other spring?
I would say they're pretty well comparable to other years. We experienced a lot more rain this year than we did, say, snow and deep freeze cycles. So it still presents the similar challenges. So our crews are out there working diligently in those conditions as well, with the rain versus the ice and the snow.
Carolyn, there is, I'm guessing, every person who calls in, the pothole in front of their house is the priority. So how do you prioritize these things? Because as I say, anyone who calls in expects you to come and do theirs. And I completely understand why they would think that. But how do you go about deciding which ones to do?
Yeah, good question, Scott. So so anybody who calls into the city through 546 City is transferred over to the transportation division, where we again assign and log the inquiry that's come forward. Our staff do an excellent job of taking all of those inquiries and actually going out to inspect, in addition to the road patrol activities that they're already doing. So there are many instances where these come in, they're prioritized, staff are out and about, they're checking them, and then they're being prioritized to be done.
Mark, we have had, and again, I don't think I'm breaking any news to you, that we have found ourselves on these lists over the years of worst roads in Ontario. And I don't think that anyone in Hamilton is too excited. Yourself, I'm guessing, right at the top of the list of founding yourself on this list. Why have we had these challenges compared to other places?
That's a great question. I believe that in comparison to other places, I do feel like we do achieve what we set out to do. We obviously observe our life cycle replacement of our road infrastructure. We work very closely with our infrastructure renewal folks and engineering and capital projects to establish when a road is becoming heavy on the maintenance side of things, what we can do from a capital side to make those repairs.
Okay, you mentioned life cycle. Let's go there for just a second, because we have had many debates at council. Now, I know you guys aren't city councilors, but we've had many debates about what money should be spent on roads or other things. Are we at the point that we do need to start looking at more than pothole filling or shave and pave or whatever it's called, and doing real road replacements in this city? Or are we still in a position where we can get by for years and years the way we're going?
Well, our maintenance...
Oh, go ahead.
Sorry. Our maintenance program does work very well hand in hand with our engineering department, and maintenance is obviously very different than life cycle replacement. So I think we do an excellent job here in the city of Hamilton to invest in our infrastructure. There is a lot of new roads going in. There is a lot of subsurface infrastructure that's renewed. And I think the residents of Hamilton can see that going forward.
Carolyn, jump in. I know you wanted to say something there.
No, I was actually going to say something very similar to what Mark was saying, is that there are a number of different treatments that are used, obviously, to increase the longevity of all roads, not just in the city of Hamilton, but other municipalities do the same. And we work in concert very closely with our colleagues in engineering to deal with our capital prioritization on, you know, temporary measures we'll say that we'll be doing out there from a maintenance perspective, versus longer strategies for, you know, resurfacing or reconstruction.
And Mark, I don't know if you know the answer to this, but let's assume a typical main road. So not necessarily one that has trucks on it all the time. I know that, say, Burlington Street or Barton, some of those streets have exceptional circumstances, but let's pick Main Street. Okay, so a typical main road in a city like ours, what is the lifespan for a road before it has to be repaired? Or redone. Yeah. I don't mean repaired, redone.
Okay, great question. There's a lot of factors that engineering will consider with that. That will include the scope of new development that's happening adjacent to that roadway. Typically, most municipalities, you're going to be somewhere in and around 100 years before you really reconstruct a road top to bottom. So yeah, it's something in that region.
Oh, wow. I thought you were going to say like 25 or 30. That's a lot. So how many of our roads in this city, I don't know if either of you know, how many of our roads are past 100 years old then? Many?
Yeah, I wouldn't be able to answer that right now, Scott, unfortunately.
Yeah, I just don't know if we're looking at many roads that are at that point now, or if we're still in the lifespan of most of the streets in the city of Hamilton.
It's a good question. Yeah, it's a good question.
Okay, so where does now the snow, I'm touching wood, the snow is done for the year, let's hope, the freezing and the snow, although it's supposed to be freezing tonight. But let's assume we're now into spring. How long does pothole and street repair go on this spring to catch up from the winter stuff?
Yeah, so that is an ongoing effort year round. Obviously, in the spring months, in the thaw that we would typically see this time of year, efforts are ramped up to match the demand. And then you'll see our seasonal programs as we migrate through the summer months with some paving programs going on there, surface treatment, shave and pave type work. But regular pothole maintenance is an absolute ongoing year-round effort.
And Mark, when you go to a party somewhere with some people and you're not at work, and you mention that you're involved in roadway maintenance, how many parties do you get to that someone doesn't mention, I have a pothole like filled in front of my house?
Yeah, that's always a topic of conversation that comes up. Yes.
I have no doubt. Carolyn Ryle, Mark Priest, really appreciate you taking time today to talk about this. Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Scott.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
There's a good chance that over the last few days you've heard about the acquittal of a man named Umar Zamir, who had been charged with killing an undercover police officer in Toronto in an underground parking garage, and was charged with first-degree murder. That trial has now happened, and as I say, he was acquitted. Well, the thing that made this, well, one of the things that made this a unique trial was that it had led to some very strong comments at the time of the charge, and him getting bail led to some very strong comments from the premier and others, including, I believe, the police chief of Toronto, that, you know, that they had taken clearly a position of believing that he may be guilty or was guilty. Turns out that, according to a court, that is not the case. But it did make me wonder as I got thinking about this and hearing about this and reading more about this case and about the decision and everything else. You know, we in this country, in this province, in this city, all over the place, we have a system that says you are innocent until proven guilty. That is the basis, the foundational basis of our criminal justice system. You are innocent until proven guilty. And yet I really wonder what percent of people truly believe that. They may say it, but I wonder what percent of people really believe that. I want to bring in Jeff Manishin. He's a criminal lawyer, a former Crown attorney here in town, joins us now. Jeff, how are you today?
Great, Scott. How about you?
I am great, but let's go to that. I think that an awful lot of people will tell you, if you were to ask them, that I believe in the presumption of innocence, but I believe if you hooked them up to a lie detector machine and injected them with sodium pentothal, a lot of those people probably, when someone is charged, assume they're guilty. You agree?
I don't know that I go quite that far, but I'll take your point and change it a little bit. Do people really have the concept? Do they really understand and get the concept of what it means to be presumed innocent? Do they really get that, as opposed to just saying, yeah, sure, I understand the idea? How many people have ever had to really wrestle with and say, okay, I have my head fully around that? That's the challenge. Because if you think about it, Scott, number one, in our society today, when are you ever called upon to presume anything? We don't generally go on presuming.
Well, I would disagree with that, because I would say we presume an awful lot, but it's usually the other way. We usually presume we're offended by people. We presume the worst about most everything in our society now, it seems.
Ooh, that's a really dark sentiment.
It's true, though.
I don't know that I'd go that far, and I can be pretty cynical at times.
I
think that's a little much, but even if we differ on that, we're talking now about a legal presumption. The idea that as a matter
right.
of law, you're required to presume something. I have to tell you that in the rest of our justice system, that's nowhere to be found. In a civil case, there's no presuming anything.
So,
in day-to-day lives, to actually be told, start by presuming this. First of all, you have to get your head on, what does it mean to presume something?
Yeah, that's true. And what does it mean?
Well,
illegally.
We say we're going to take it as given until otherwise is established, until we're shown otherwise. We're going to start with, this is the approach we're going to take as being the case. We're going to start with that. It's not fixed. We haven't decided it. We're starting with, call it, two sets to love, okay, out of a five-set match, that this is going to be the outcome.
So when you go to court, and let's say you've got a client who is on trial, and you look at the jury, and it's a jury trial, because, I mean, I'm going to leave out the judge alone part, because I'm going to assume, and maybe this is not fair, but I'm going to assume that judges are able to do this and we feel confident that's the case. I hope that's the case in our system. But if you have a jury of people's peers, and you look at them at the start of a trial, do you get the sense that they have presumed that? Is there any way to know that? Do you have a feeling about that, or do you not?
I don't presume they know it. So what I do, and Scott, I've been doing it for several years with jury trials, and I've come to think about it as an important part of the defense counsel's role, is spend some time explaining to them what it means to presume something, what it means to presume innocence, and to point out that in a criminal trial, the parties don't start off even. It's not the Crown and the defense, and let's see who's telling the truth, or let's see who can make their case. The accused starts out with the presumption of innocence, and it stays with him unless and until the Crown proves otherwise, to the standard in law of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So I start by spending some time on that, both concepts, presumption of innocence, burden of proof on the Crown, and standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, because we never have to deal with those sorts of things in our day-to-day lives, so I want people to at least get a primer on that.
You know, it's a really, court cases, criminal cases in particular, do for that point, the presumption of innocence, but also beyond a reasonable doubt has, I think, become a very complicated, maybe it's always been, but has become a very complicated few words, because there are some people who interpret that as beyond any doubt, which is unreasonable, but then you also can't say, well, it's just 50-50. It's a really interesting choice of words to try and interpret what that means.
We've had it for a long time, and in fact, judges have instructions as to what to tell the jury, and that instruction has been modified and adapted over the course of time. For one stage, used to use the phrase, to a moral certainty. But you don't quite hear that now. The concept is not a mathematical certainty, and a judge tells them that. but to the point where you can essentially say, look, I do not have even a reasonable doubt left. I am satisfied to the point where no reasonable doubt remains based on the evidence. And again, day-to-day lives, we never have to do that. But it's integral to the jury system it has. I mean, if we went back 50 years, the jury would be told the same thing, proof beyond a reasonable doubt. States, Canada, England, Australia, same thing.
And you say that we don't have this in our everyday lives because that word reasonable is one that I know that the jury would get instructions, but that's a really challenging word because my reasonable doubt might be different from your reasonable doubt, no?
Well, the jury would be told it has to be based on the logical processes of the mind. It's not fanciful. It's not emotional. It's not speculative. It's got to be real. It's got to be a genuine doubt. It's not one that got conjured up by a juror who's timid and looking to avoid his or her task. But in this case, Scott, I have to get into on the Zamir case. This isn't a case about did the jury get it right or not. I think everybody agrees they got it right.
Sounds like it.
The lessons out of this case are a different track, if you don't mind us steering us there,
yep,
to just did the jury get it right or not. And let's start with, as you mentioned it, when you have people like Doug Ford and Patrick Brown, mayor of Brampton, and John Tory, then Toronto mayor, and Ford says at the time of a bail decision to let somebody out, it's beyond comprehension. Tory says it's almost impossible to imagine how he could get jail. Okay, that Tory calls it wrong and disgusting, and Brown is completely unacceptable, and Ford, another example of the bail system putting criminals ahead of victims. You and I have talked about the bail system, Scott, and to pick up on something you mentioned, people don't think about it. The presumption of innocence applies at the bail stage, too, you know. And more significant than that, we have a system in Canada where decisions on bail aren't published because we want to preserve the person's right to a fair trial. There are things that come out of the bail hearing that may never come out of the trial.
So
there's non-publication order for the evidence of the bail hearing. We know that. But Doug Ford had something that you and I don't have. You know what he has, Scott? He has an attorney general that he can contact and say, I want to know what happened on this. I want a report from the Crown, and I want a summary of the reasons to why this person got bail. He didn't do that. Mm. He clearly couldn't have done that. I've gotten people out on bail on murder cases, and I have to tell you this, it's rare. When a judge lets somebody out on bail on a murder case, it means there's a very legitimate basis to defend the case. I presume that. That's because I'm within the system. I would like to have the reasonable people, the members of the public, do the same, Scott. And one of the reasons I come on a program like yours is to try and educate people on that, to say, look, we don't know the evidence. Can you at least allow for the fact that a very experienced, knowledgeable Superior Court judge decides I'm going to let the person out on bail with a burdens on the accused to show why he should get out, why he shouldn't be detained? Why do you need to appeal to public sentiment like Ford, like Tory, like Brown? How can you get so carried? What is in it for you to do that? I could look at Doug Ford and I say, you have no shame, sir. Why would you do that?
Let me ask this question, though, and we only have a minute left, and I wish we had a lot more time, but let me ask this, because bail has become a really a difficult one, because if you hold someone on bail who doesn't deserve to be there, you are punishing them unquestionably wrongly. If, however, you let someone out on bail and they, as we've seen with other cases, commit other infractions while they are out on bail, then someone else has been hurt because of the decision and it blows up. So how do we with confidence make these kind of decisions?
Oh, there's an element of balance. There's an element of legal principles. There's an element of evidence. There are even capacities for review if the initial judge or justice gets it wrong. That one, there's lots of room for balance. It's never going to be perfect. You're going to have, for sure, we don't want to have people detained if they shouldn't be. Have somebody detained and ultimately they're acquitted, that's something the system doesn't want. So sure, you want to take the care you can to make sure you aren't releasing somebody who might represent a real risk. But on the other hand, you want to ensure that somebody who should get bail gets bail, and you don't have public officials say, oh, it's wrong, when they don't know anything.
Last thing.
This is a part two, because we haven't touched on police officers.
Yeah, that will have to be.
On their notes, are criticized by a judge, and what about accountability there? Okay, let's do a part two, if you like, on that one.
That will have to be a part two. Just very quickly, though, about the bail thing, are there additional extra exaggerated, I don't know what the word is, penalties, if you were to be let out on bail and you were to commit another crime, do judges extra harshly add time, not just because there's a second crime, not just penalizing you for the second crime, do you get penalized extra because we gave you the benefit of the doubt and then you went and did something again.
Absolutely. Not only that, aggravating circumstance to commit an offense while on bail, number one. Number two, there's a separate criminal offense of breaching your conditions of release. Number three, if you breach your condition of release, the Crown may then apply when you're picked up on the breach to have bail revoked. But certainly, if an offense was committed while awaiting trial and other offenses, aggravating circumstance on sentence, increasing the sentence.
That is Jeff Banish, and we need hours rather than minutes when we talk about these things, but minutes are what we had today. So, Jeff, I always appreciate you doing this. Thank
Certainly.
You.
Certainly. My pleasure, Scott, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to try and ensure people get a clear perspective on this.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
We learned just the other day that the class of 2024 for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, who they are, who is going to be going into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and who are they? 8 inductees. I believe that may be a record. They are Mary J. Blige, Cher, Dave Matthews Band, Foreigner, Peter Frampton, Kool and the Gang, Ozzy Osbourne, and A Tribe Called Quest. I'll let you chew on those for a couple seconds to decide whether you think that that is a good class or a bad class, but here to discuss it. And those who, once again, did not make it in, Eric Alper, who's a publicist and a music commentator and a man who has done everything in the music community and the music world except sing a duet with Taylor Swift, but I understand that's coming up later this year. Eric, how are you?
I'm good. I don't know if I would be able to handle the pressure of actually being in the same room as Taylor Swift. I think it would, I would just suck the air out of
you
it.
You think so? Well, you know what? I think it'd be worth a try. And now that they have, what do you call it? That auto tone or whatever. I mean, even if it would work. You'd sound brilliant. You'd sound like Pavarotti if you were singing along with her. It'd be great.
Yeah. Look, if with my million followers on social media and her followers on social media, combined, we'll have 751 million social media followers. So, Taylor, call me.
So you heard the names. You saw the names going into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Mary J. Blige, Cher, Dave Matthews, Foreigner, Pete Frampton, Kool and the Gang, Ozzy Osbourne, A Tribe Called Quest. Who are you most excited about going in? Who of that group do you go, man, I am so glad they're going in?
I'm going to cheat and I'm going to say a couple of people.
Okay.
I think Cher, even though that she's reacted to her induction saying that she wouldn't be in it if they gave her $1 million.
Really?
I didn't hear that.
Okay. So she's pulling the Marlon Brando thing here.
She's pulling the Dolly Parton and saying, I don't want to be in it. She's pulling a Sex Pistols. Sex Pistols didn't want to do anything with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame when they got inducted and they didn't even show up. It's going to be fascinating to see if Cher actually goes because, you know, look, this is an artist who is so legendary. I mean, 6-decade career, multitude of hits, but she's also had 15 different farewell tours. So she actually might go back on this word. The most interesting one to me is Foreigner, and not so much that I'm a fan of the band I think most people are.
Yeah. But everybody knows their songs.
They've got a ton of them,
and everyone knows them.
But one of the leaders of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame was Jan Wenner. And Jan was the founder and the publisher of Rolling Stone magazine. In fact, it was his idea, along with a couple of other very big heavyweights in the music industry, to create the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in the first place. It was no secret during the 70s and 80s that Jan Wenner hated all of these white bread male rock and roll band that were selling out arenas around the world. Foreigner, Styx, Kansas, Journey, you know, REO Speedwagon, artists that seemingly now still continue to get played on radio stations around the world. But when Jan Wenner got kicked out of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame because he wrote a book and didn't include a lot of people of color, didn't include any women in his book on legendary rock and rollers, he got canceled or cancel culture, or he got quite slammed and he had to leave the board. That opened up the door to, I think, one of the biggest gatekeepers of that kind of music. And I think now that Foreigner got in, I think all of the people that were complaining that, well, what about Journey and Styx and these great bands that sold tens of millions of albums? I think that now you'll start to see maybe artists like the Guess Who get in.
That was when I was
never a big fan of them.
That was when I was going to ask. Now, Journey did get in back in 2017, but even as you were mentioning those names, I was doing a frantic search here, and I believe of that list you gave, I think they're the only ones that have cracked the code yet to get in there until now with Foreigner. Yeah. And yes, he did. As I recall, I read something yesterday, I guess, that said an old quote of his that says, like, I'll die before they get into the Hall of Fame. Like, he was, like, adamant that they were, that Foreigner was, and he had weirdly picked out Foreigner as his example, even though they had all these groups that, as you say, he didn't love. Foreigner weirdly was the one that he, like, went to the mat for, against.
Foreigner were so symbolic of corporate rock when, you know, magazines like Rolling Stone and Trouser Press and NME in the UK were salivating and writing about the cool hip people. They were writing about Patti Smith. They were writing about the Pistols. They were writing about the Clash, artists that seemingly ended up in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but certainly never sold the sheer amount of copies that they did. And keep in mind, you know, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is a museum. It's an important piece of musical artifact. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's a tourist attraction. And the more that they open up what they deem rock and roll to be, the more that they allow and vote A Tribe Called Quest or Mary J. Blige, the more of a different audience that might be able to be willing to go into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as a visit. And, you know, they're kind of running out of bands to do, because now, in order to be eligible, you have to have your first album out by 25 years.
Yeah.
So right now they're looking at artists that are eligible for next year are artists whose first album was in the 2000s. That means that, you know, artists like, say, the Backstreet Boys and NSYNC and Britney Spears are going to be at least eligible. And this is going to be interesting if you're a fan of this kind of stuff, is like, you know, you think people are complaining now about Mary J. getting into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or Dolly Parton getting into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Just wait until they start to run out of those rock and rollers and they have to start thinking about the pop artists and the rap artists, and that's going to be fun.
Okay, so here's some of the things as we go through it. And like, it's always an interesting list of those who didn't get in as much as it's interesting of who did get in. And you just touched on why some of those bands like Foreigner, Journey, Styx, the rest haven't got in. Styx should definitely be in, but that's, you know, that's just a thing. Anyway, one of the things when Cher goes in and Mary J. Blige goes in, and they're not the same, but, you know, I'm going to put them in that category of diva-ish. And I use that phrase only because we tend to use that when you talk about successful single female artists, whether it's a fair use of the word or not, I don't know, but that's sort of what gets thrown around. How in the world are they in? And I'm not taking issue with them being in there. How in the world are they in and Diana Ross is not in?
Yeah, that's an interesting theory. I would put Diana Ross in the same thinking as the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has a little bit of a problem differentiating between lead artists in a group and them as a solo artist. And Diana Ross should be in there. Phil Collins should be in there. Phil Collins is one of only three artists in history to sell 100 million albums in both a band and a solo artist. You know, the other two are Michael Jackson and Paul McCartney. Stevie Nicks of Fleetwood Mac has gotten in twice as both solo and that. So
all the Beatles have, right? Individually and as a band.
Ringo Starr, unsurprisingly, he was the last one to kind of get in there. But yeah, it's an interesting question where, you know, which makes somebody like Ozzy Osbourne not much of a surprise, but a rare case to them where he's already in there as a member of Black Sabbath, and now Ozzy Osbourne gets in as a solo artist. So, yeah, it's kind of fascinating to see who they will let go through both. I mean, Eric Clapton is in there three times as both a solo artist, a member of the Yardbirds, and Derek and the Dominoes. So, and Cream. So, sometimes, you know, it's never linear as much as people want. But Mary J. and Cher is interesting because it's a new kind of performer that they're going to have to take a look at. It's the singer dancer, and it's not a singer songwriter like a James Taylor or people who never performed with an instrument. Cher doesn't play an instrument. Mary J. doesn't play an instrument. They might have produced things here and there, but like the singer dancer entertainer kind of people.
Oh, wait till Britney Spears comes up for consideration.
Oh, she's a lock. Well, she is an absolute lock.
You just mentioned, though, okay, another one. Phil Collins, he's in as part of Genesis, but not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as Phil Collins. I think there are, maybe I'm overstating this, I think there are as many people who know Phil Collins for Phil Collins as they do for Genesis. I think his solo career was at least as impactful as his group career.
Oh, without question. But, yeah, and I'm just not saying that because I'm out and about obsessive fan of him. But what's also interesting about this list too, so some people may or may not know, they also have some what's called a Musical Excellence Award. And this is just left up to the judges to decide about artists that might have not sold a lot of copies. Maybe they weren't on the ballot originally. Maybe they didn't get enough votes if they were on the ballot. But maybe things have happened that, you know, make them deserving of getting in there. There were four this year. Norman Whitfield from the days of Motown, which is great. Dionne Warwick, who, you know, I mean, she's just a Twitter goddess. So I think she gets in there because she seems to be more popular, at least not for her music, but certainly out there. MC5, they sold, you know, 18 copies. Proto-punk, legendary status. Jimmy Buffett got in.
Yeah. And I forgot about Jimmy Buffett. Yes.
Yeah. And this is interesting because I don't think Jimmy Buffett gets in unless he passes away. And to that, I'm surprised that Sinead O'Connor didn't get in because she passed away. I don't think Sinead O'Connor gets in if she doesn't have all of these tributes and accolade and makes people remember her stance on so many issues. She was more punk and rock and roll than most of these people who did get in there. So, you know, but it's fun to talk about.
Let me throw another name then, because I would argue, again, if you're talking about, and we'll use the phrase diva for, you know, whether people like it or not, there was someone who was as much impactful on the launch of sort of 80s music, I would argue, Cyndi Lauper, who has not made it in. And I kind of put her in that, and I mean, is Cyndi Lauper one of the greatest performers of all time? I don't know. Was she impactful? I think she was. I think she was really
absolutely
impactful.
And she had the hits, and she can still sell out, you know, mid-sized concert venues. And certainly she's made her presence known in politics and for LGBTQIA plus rights. The Indigo Girls should be in there as well. One name that did not get in, which I think was the biggest surprise to me, as much as it could be a surprise, was Mariah Carey. I mean, 150 million album. She owns 4 months of the whole season from the day after Halloween. It's Mariah Carey season.
That's true. I mean, some of the other ones who did not get in this time, you've mentioned, and I just, there's a lot. There's a lot of people who are on the snub list, but that every year leap off the page to me. We said Diana Ross, Iron Maiden. Don't know how Iron, I mean, if you're talking Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, how they're not in there. The Guess Who you mentioned. Here's one that, you know, Jim Croce, which... And again, like, I might not have under normal circumstances said that Jim Croce would be Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but the way that this has been broadened essentially to all popular music Hall of Fame, how he's not in there, I don't know. And if that's the case, if the definition has now broadened to we are going to be talking about all people who have produced popular music and sold a million different albums, 10 million, 100 million different albums, how are the Carpenters not in there?
Yeah, I agree. And you know what? There was a time when I think, you know, it might have been too soon for them. But, you know, certainly in the 1990s, Kurt Cobain of Nirvana and Sonic Youth and Rage Against the Machine all bowed down to the Carpenters in terms of their songwriting. Bryan Adams is not in the Hall of Fame. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, look, you know, other than maybe a couple of albums past Reckless, a lot of Americans just don't really think about Bryan Adams. And so that's part of it too, is, you know, what's your relevance now? Like, BTO sold millions of albums around the world.
All right, but what's, what's Peter Frampton's relevance now? I mean, he put out an album Once Upon a Time that sold 4 trillion album copies. But when, I mean, has Peter Frampton done anything recently? And so, and I'm not taking away from Peter Frampton, like, he deserves to be there. But if you're going to say, well, Bryan Adams hasn't done anything significant in a while, there's tons of the people who go in who haven't done anything significant in a while. That's sort of a standard thing. What's Ozzy Osbourne done lately?
Yeah, exactly. Well, Ozzy Osbourne has kind of stayed alive. I mean, if I mean, Ozzy Osbourne with the Osbournes probably made him more popular than any of his solo artists. But Peter Frampton is an interesting one because, you know, back in 1976, when Frampton Comes Alive came out, not only was it the biggest selling album of all time at the time in America, but he was the biggest solo rock star on the planet, and then seemingly got, you know, just absolutely ignored with his next album, you know, got a huge backlash, played with David Bowie on his live albums and his solo albums for a number of years, and still continues to tour, but, you know, a lot of very public health issues when it comes to Peter. So I think a lot of the older people thought, if we're going to give it to him, let's give it to him when he's alive. And he can deserve it, rather than maybe missing out. Sometime it's too late.
All right, let me throw two more at you in the time we have of the people who, should they get in, should they not? I don't know how you gauge this. I mean, because we've both pointed out there's people who have sold all kinds of albums, and maybe their taste, maybe their music is not to everyone's taste. I don't know. How is Meatloaf not in?
Yeah, Meatloaf.
And again, a long time ago, but back when Bat Out of Hell came out, and then the sequel, like it was, for the longest time, was it not the best-selling album in the world?
Yep. I mean, he's been eligible since 1997, and his music is still heard every single day in classic rock radio. Oh, for sure. I think the one thing that he might have harmed his chances was he was a very public and vocal anti-vaxxer. And although that everybody has a right to do whatever they want to do in life, when it comes to voting, that kind of turned off a lot of the liberal media who actually vote for this kind of stuff.
It does seem ironic that someone who doesn't want to put drugs into their body is going to be kept out. And some of these people like Ozzy, who put every drug into his body, is
That's
getting
the game.
In. Okay. The other one. Okay. Here is maybe, I would argue, one of the most interesting ones to consider, because I truly don't know if they came to me and said, Scott, you now have the deciding vote. This guy can go into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or not. You decide. I truly have no idea what I would say about this. Weird Al Yankovic.
Oh, see, I would agree. I would put him in.
You would. I wouldn't object if he was, and I wouldn't feel bent out of shape if he wasn't, because I don't know what you do with a guy like that.
I think that if Weird Al gets on the ballot, it would be the most votes the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has ever received.
That's probably true.
There's a couple of them that I'm still kind of shaking my. I think In Excess should be in there. I think Don Henley should be in there.
Don Henley's not in as a solo.
Don Henley is not in. David Gilmour of Pink Floyd is not in as a solo member. You know, I don't know. Like, you know, I don't know. Like, Devo is, Roger Daltrey, The Cult, The Black Crowes. So there's still a lot left to go, but I think they're going to have to figure out very, very quickly to expand this this 8 and maybe bring it to 15 or 16 just to start letting in people.
Well, you mentioned that, you know, they have a hard time with lead singers of bands, and what do you do with them with their solo career? I don't know if I mentioned this or not. I had the name written down. I can't remember if I said it, but you mentioned Phil Collins is not in, and yet Peter Gabriel is in as a solo artist. And I'm like, okay,
Peter Gabriel was cool.
Well, okay. Is that all it is, that Peter?
Yeah, it's artistic merit. And just, you know, a lot of people just didn't appreciate, I think, Phil Collins' overexposure back in the mid-1980s. Yeah.
Okay, last thing, and Ben just whispered in my ear, and it's a very good point, and you and I may have talked about this last year at this time. I don't know. Should they change the name of this place to the Popular Music Hall of Fame as opposed to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
No, I'm actually pretty good with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And it's not that I don't want to deny, you know, rap or hip hop or R&B or disco. But to me, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame was really all about the spirit of rock and roll. Because don't forget, like, rock and roll was just a merger of R&B music and country music. So without those two styles, you don't even have rock and roll in the begin with. And there's something about the youth culture part of it that I definitely appreciate. And that's why I never complain when Mary J gets in, or, you know, somebody like that, that may not necessarily be, quote, rock and roll with guitars and drums and bass and a singer. To me, it's all about, like, what kind of blew teenagers' minds for a long time. And I think that's where we're going to end up with the Britneys and New Kids on the Block and Backstreet Boys and NSYNC in the coming years.
You know, when the day comes that Britney Spears goes into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I think a whole bunch of us are going to, I don't know, put bags.
Go to Cleveland.
Well, I don't know what to, it's coming. I'm with you. It's coming. I can't even imagine. Yeah, well, let's just leave. Let's not have to consider that till we have to consider that.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Same time next year. We'll figure it all out.
Yeah, there's Eric Alper. Always love having you on, Eric. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks, man.
The Scott Radley Show. Weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.